So first of all, kol hakavod for everybody who came to the shiur this morning and heroic stance. But obviously, you all believe in the view of Rav Aviner from Beit El that all you need is 4 hours to prepare for Pesach. Because when he said it a few years ago, there was the women's organization wanted to kill him.
So you're speaking to the men now. They give 4 hours.
Rivka Bukoshi 4 hours they give. Bukoshi 4 hours. That's if you're lucky.
My husband didn't need any time.
Okay, there you go. Okay. So that's number one. Number two, next week obviously Chol HaMoed we won't have a shiur, but the week after, 2 weeks from today, we resume and we'll get back to the Rav on Sefer Shmot. I'm happy to tell you that the Sefer on Vayikra just came out. So, but that will be for next year, but until we get through with Shmot. But what I'd like to do for the interim between Pesach and Shavuot is, being that the Aseret HaDibrot factor in Parshat Yitro, and that's just about where we were up to before we broke off for Purim and Pesach studies. So I'd like to give several shiurim from the Rav on the subject of the Aseret HaDibrot. And that, I think, will prepare us to Chag HaShavuot, and then we'll just continue along after Chag HaShavuot. That's the battle plan, at least. Or the game plan, let's call it the game plan. Yeah. But it's Milchamta Shel Torah, so it's a battle plan also. Okay. This particular source sheet carries not my usual title, but it says, Mekorot Deshur Klali Yeshivat Bnei Akiva Ner Tamid. Many years ago, at the Yeshiva Chashbonoim, I gave a general shiur to the entire student body, and we invited parents as well. I think it was an evening of learning towards Pesach, and I prepared this particular source sheet. But before we get to the source sheet, or if we'll get to the source sheet, the number four is a number that is obviously very popular on the Seder night. We speak of the four cups and the four sons and the four questions and the four expressions of Geula, Ba'ala Shanot Geula. So number four is a very popular number. And to that end, there are many, many homiletic insights that have been suggested throughout the ages. I'm sure if you pick up a Haggadah that has an anthology of thoughts for Seder night, somebody's got to talk about the number four. Just 2 weeks ago at the Shir Hadash Minyan that's held in the Ol Nechama facility, so there was a Yom Iyun for Pesach. Then I gave a shir entitled Arba'a Miyodeya. I gave it also in shul in Hebrew, but the Shir Chadash, their language of instruction is English. But it makes no difference. Elu ne'amarin b'chol lashon, the Mishnah Masechet Sota. You can fulfill Talmud Torah in all languages. And although you have the song Echad Miyodeya, Shnai Miyodeya, Shlosha Miyodeya, it goes all the way up to 13, I focused on the Arba Imahot. Arba miyodeya, arba ani yodeya, arba imahot, who are, of course, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Which sometimes you might miss it and think it's the four wives of Yaakov, but it's not the case, because Bilhah and Zilpah are really subsidiaries to Rachel and Leah. And that can be proven clearly from the Psukim, that, first of all, it's clear that Bilhah enters into the picture because Rachel is childless and she brings Bilhah into the picture. And then the question is, why is Zilpah brought into the picture after Leah is, Baruch Hashem, collecting, Kitzbat Yeladim for quite a bunch? Already she has 7 children, 6 boys and a girl. So that's a question in itself. But it probably has something to do with the Ruach HaKodesh factor of knowing that there'll be 12 Shvatim, and so on. But so Bilhah and Zilpah really belong to Rachel and Leah. But it comes out very clearly when Rachel dies, and Yaakov moves into the tent of Bilhah, because she's an extension of Rachel. Of course, Reuven, the oldest son of Leah, wasn't particularly happy about that, and the rest is history. But the four Imahot are Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. I got to know a very, very wonderful teacher of Tanakh, Rav Eliyo Yedid. I don't know how many of you are familiar with him, but when I was teaching in the Amuna College back in the early 90s, so he was there teaching Tanakh. He also taught at the Michlala here in Yerushalayim, by Fagan. He taught in the Midrashah of Bar Ilan for the young ladies. And he was a known commodity in the world of teaching. That's correct. Sheva Neviot. The Gemara talks about that there were 48 Nevi'im and 7 women who are prophets, 7 Nevi'ot. So he gave a course called Sheva Nevi'ot, and he focused on the 7 personalities, women personalities in Tanakh, who were also prophets. He wrote a book, and I actually had it at home, but you know, like many people have Sfarim that they get as gifts and they never look at, and they put it on the shelf and so on. And I gave this title to the Shir Chadash group. I'll speak about the Arba Imahot. I wasn't 100% sure what I was going to do with the topic. And usually what I do is I sit by the computer and I put in the disk of the responsa from Bar Ilan just to give me all the sources at my fingertips. And I see, staring at my eye level at a bookcase, it says Arba Imahot Ve'em Shel Malchut Harav Elio Yedid. Rav Yedid wrote a sefer on the 4 Imahot and the 5th. Who's the 5th? Rut. Rut, the mother of monarchy. Eim shel, ima shel, malchut. And I said, wow, you know, as my kids would say, voila, you know, like, you know, this. And I opened, took it a look at it. They said, you know what, I'm going to get some ideas about the Arba Imahot from Rav Yedid, which I did. And I sifted out some ideas beyond what I myself had in mind what to say. But what was interesting is that Rav Yedid posits that not only, as everyone knows, behind every great man stands a great woman. That we've heard from, you know, lesser people than Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. There was probably some truth to it also. It's not just a statement. But the idea that Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah were indispensable for Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. It's not that they were just a healthy add-on, but they were indispensable. And the truth is, I remember the Rav saying this in a shir, which at one occasion many years ago, those who were here 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, maybe even more, when I did for the year, I did the hespedim that the Rav delivered at various occasions. So one of them was the hesped for Sarah Imenu. The Torah says, Lispod the Sarah b'lifkota, but it doesn't say what the hesped was. So the Rav was kind enough to write the hesped for Avraham Avinu. And he says that the truth is, if we examine the Chumash, you see that after Avraham Avinu, after Sarah Imenu passes away, Avraham lives another 38 years and we hardly know a thing about him. The only thing we know is that he's very concerned about who's going to marry Yitzchak. Because he's concerned that the next generation of the Avot is appropriately filled with an appropriate batzug, spouse for Yitzchak. But in terms of Avraham per se, just as Sarah passes away, he goes on living, but he walks off the stage of history. Avraham Avinu has nothing more to say to Am Yisrael for generations. And which indicates that without Sarah, basically, Avraham runs out of gas. And he's living as a human being. But in terms of perpetuating something for Am Yisrael for generation, it has come to an end. And hence the Imahot were clearly indispensable to what the Avot were doing. And beyond indispensable, beyond being Ezer Kenegdo, they also had very unique things that through them, these characteristics became part and parcel of Am Yisrael. So we know the Chazal speak about certain characteristics of Am Yisrael that are part of our calling card, you know, Kartiz Bikur. One is being Gomel Chesed. So if you look at Rivka, so what the Eved Avraham, who Chazal identify as Eliezer, was looking for in a Shidduch for Yitzchak was one quality. One quality, right? What was that one quality? Does a father have money? No, not that quality. Right? We used to call it in America, a girl with a PhD, Papa has dough. Geld. Right. So, Chesed, that's all he was concerned about. That she should be effervescent with Chesed. So this Rivka really implants into the fabric of what would become Am Yisrael. Sarah is very much partnered with Avraham Avinu in the concept of Hakrava. Hakrava means self-sacrifice. And it not only has something to do with the Akedah, where Avraham Avinu's willingness to sacrifice because HaKadosh Baruch Hu simply said so, and although HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately is not interested in having Yitzhak slaughtered on the Mizbeach, but the willingness, the Hineni factor of Avraham Avinu is part and parcel of Am Yisrael. We're willing to do this until this very day, to give up our lives for HaKadosh Baruch Hu if that's what we're called upon to do. And there are episodes both in the Chumash and in the Medrash which indicates that Sarah was more than an Ezer Kenegdo when it comes to Hakrava. And Rav Yedid goes on to prove this point, that Sarah represented sacrifice, and Rivka represented Chesed, and Rachel and Leah represented Malchut, monarchy, what would ultimately be statehood in modern language, modern political language, statehood. And you see this in Megillat Rut, where Boaz and Rut are being blessed, that the Rut should be like Rachel Veleah. So why did they just fish out Rachel Veleah? Because the realization was that that's going to be what Ruth's all about. She's the fifth matriarch here, and she's carrying on the mission of Rachel and Leah. Where Rachel and Leah, they were just setting the theory into motion of what would become Am Yisrael through 12 tribes. And even though they themselves fought, mothered, gave birth to 8 of the 12, but as I say again, Bilhah is the responsibility of Rachel and Zilpah is the responsibility of Leah. So they really gave birth to the 12 Shvatim. And this ultimately would become Klal Yisrael. And as we see in the brachot that Yaakov Avinu gives at the end of Vayechi, he gives them each individual brachot, as Shamshon Rafal Hirsch points out in Parshat Toledot. He says, you didn't give them all brachot that they're going to be, you know, Rabbanim and Kohanim. They're not going to sit in Kailul. That's not what Am Yisrael is all about. But you have to have some people who are going to be dedicated to the spiritual pursuits, but you have to have farmers, you have to have business people, and you have to have statesmen, you have to have soldiers. If you want to have a state, and he calls it a healthy state, Bria, healthy state, you have to have all these factors. And this is really what the mission of Am Yisrael was all about. And each Shevet was gifted with a particular talent and ability to answer the call to a specific area of national life. And that's how Rav Hirsch sees the Am Yisrael factor. So Rav Yedid points out that Rachel and Leah kicked the theory into motion, whereas Ruth already is closer to David HaMelech. She's the great grandmother of David HaMelech, as we see the last psukim of Ruth, of Megillat Ruth, just simply brings down the genealogy to Yishai, and Yishai holded David. That's the last word of Megillat Ruth, David, and so on. So she's the Ima Shel Malchut. So you have these characteristics of Hakrava, of sacrifice, of Chesed, and statehood, the way we understand it, as being the role of the matriarchs. So if you want to know Arba'a Miyodea, Arba'a Aniyodea, so it's not just, all right, and now we're up to 3, and now we're up to 2, and now we're up to 1. The focus on the Arba Imahot is very, very, very critical, especially since a lot of people like to talk about the number 4, as I mentioned earlier, with the Arba Kosot, and the Arba Sheilot, and the Arba Lashonot Geula, and the Arba Banim. Yet, the number 4, with regard to Leila Seder, is a temporary phenomenon. Temporary. Because the ideal number for Seder night is actually 5. It's actually 5. It's not 4. We've downgraded to 4 because of things that are absent. And let's try to spell it out. So bless Facebook and internet and my family who thinks it's a mitzvah to, as they say, le balbelli at the moach, with all these pictures and cartoons that one is funnier than the next for all kinds of occasions. So just yesterday comes in on the phone a picture of a child, a kid dressed up, he's wearing a Superman shirt, but okay, and he's explaining why he's not going to drink the Koshel Eliyahu, because the last time he sat on Eliyahu's seat... didn't work out too well for him. So he's not going to drink the Koshel Eliyahu. No. The Rambam tells us, with regard to the 4 cups, that there are those who drink a 5th cup. He writes it as an option. There are those who drink a 5th cup. Now the Rambam does not tell us what we Ashkenazim have the custom to do, and that is to pour out a 5th cup and just leave it there, and say, Shvoch HaMatcha LaGoyim, open the door, and not drink that wine. There is such a minhag, by the way, not everybody has this, but to use that gavia with wine for Kiddush the next morning. But I would recommend that you cover it with something, okay? Put a little plastic bag over it, because you never know, exposed to the elements overnight, you might find a few things swimming in the wine the next morning. you got to be careful. But so why kosher l'Eliyahu? I've already heard people ask me if the kosher l'Eliyahu has to be a revi'it. Does it have to be a revi'it of the Chazon Ish Ashir? I mean, how much you have kosher l'Eliyahu? So I'm not going to even bother answering that. But why pour out a kosher l'Eliyahu? So according to the theme that's brought down in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the last parak, alluding to the four cups, and I say alluding, what's called remez and asmachta, not the halachic reason, as most of us thought when we were growing up and studying, the allusion to the four cups of the four expressions of geula. And I've said this here in the shir already, that many people will ask you, you know, why do we drink four cups of wine? They'll spit out, v'hotzeiti, v'yitzalti, v'ga'alti, v'lakachti. I think I said here and shared that my daughter had asked me this a few years ago when she was studying in Migdal Oz, which is the women's division of Yeshivat Har Etzion. Abba, why do we drink four cups? And I said, because Chazal instituted that the four mitzvahs of the night of the Seder should be accompanied with a koshel bracha. She looks at me and says, how did you know that? I said, because you heard it from Rav Meidan, who heard it from Rav Lichtenstein, who heard it from the Rav. But I heard it from the Rav, so, you know, I had a better source. Klisheni einu mevashel. I heard it from the source. And what the Rav was saying was that the first and the third cups of wine at the Seder night are nothing at all unique to Leila Seder. Kiddush is Kiddush. We make Kiddush Friday night. We make Kiddush every Yom Tov night. And a cup of wine on Birkat HaMazon, while you might not do it for every Wednesday morning breakfast, but if you have a Zimun with 10 people, it's pretty customary to do it over a cup of wine. It's not something you have to do, but it's something that we do. It's something that we're familiar with. To have Kiddush, to have Birkat HaMazon, Zimun with 10 people over a cup of wine. So a cup of wine over Birkat HaMazon that we do on Seder night is clearly not unique for Seder night per se. What is unique? The second and the fourth cup. The second cup is on the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. Now, one second, don't we mention Mitzrayim throughout the year? Of course we do, but it's a token mentioning. Leman tizkor et yom tzeitra mi'ez Mitzrayim, kol yimecha. You can fulfill it in 15 seconds or less. But Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim is a not just storytelling, it's also storytelling, but not just storytelling, but it's an in-depth analysis of the mitzvot and halachot of the night. And hence you can have five of the luminaries of the Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Elazar Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon, and they're sitting the whole night. If it's storytelling, most probably they could have wrapped it up in 10 minutes. But it's not storytelling. It's in-depth halachic analysis. And ein beit midrash lelo chidush. Every time you sit down to study Torah, you know, you don't say, hey, I learned this Masechet already. What do you mean you learned this Masechet already? You learned it already? Finished? That's it? You don't have to learn it again? I once had a student that came for an interview in Chashmonaim. And he came from a different yeshiva, whatever reasons, he was a transfer student. And I told him that we're studying such and such Gemara this year in the yeshiva. Tells me, I learned it already. Oh yeah? Oh, that guy was in big trouble. He was in big trouble. I asked him three questions. He struck out. I had three pitches and he was out. And I said, you have still something to learn in this Masechet. Don't tell me you learned this already, you know? It says, ain't no domed, there's no comparison. Somebody who learns a perek 100 times to the one who learns it 101 times. What's the difference, 101 times? You never know what thought might enter into your head the 101st time. The Rav even went further and he said, you know, the number 100 smacks of finality. You know, you get 100 on an exam, you run the 100-yard dash, whatever, you know, 100 miles. 100 is a nice round number. By going to the 101st time, you're making a statement that there is no final line, there's no end line in Torah. You're always continuing. That's the 101st. So the idea that Leila Seder is Talmud Torah, fine, we understand that. So you have Otzei, so that's why it's a special mitzvah, Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, and that's why there's a cup of wine attached to it. And the cup of wine is while we drink it at the end of the section of Magid, it's poured out at the beginning of the section of Magid. Right before Manishtan, they pour out the second cup. And you know what they did in Volozhin? They said the Haggadah, the Magid part, holding the cup of wine. Like you hold it for Kiddush, or Avdallah, or under the Chuppah, somebody getting a bracha, you hold the cup of wine. Now, that's a long time to hold a cup of wine, right? So they didn't, the Rav said, well, don't think they held the cup of wine for 2 hours. they put it down when they discussed things. But every time they read a section, they would pick up the cup of wine. Now, our minhag is to do that symbolically on several occasions, where the Haggadah says, lift up the cup of wine. V'hi sha'amda, right? We pick up the cup of wine. L'fichach anachnu chayavim lehodot. Says, pick up the cup of wine. So we're, you know, good children, and we listen to the printer who says, pick up the cup of wine. But in Valojin, the minhag was to pick up the cup of wine every time. Avodah Behinu, whenever they were saying the Haggadah and not carrying out discussion, they were holding a cup of wine because this was like an elongated, a long-winded Kiddush. And we pick up the cup of wine at the end when we say the bracha Gaal Yisrael, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Asher Gaalanu V'Gaal Avotenu, and then Baruch Pei Gafen. Clearly, that's, you know, the zar, that's not just zar, that's obligatory. But with regard to holding it for the entire Magid, that's a little bit of a chumrah. And I think the reason why Am Yisrael, you know, never went for that because it was just too much. It's called Gzeirah Shatzibur Lo Yechola La'amod Bo. It's something you can't ask the people to do. You can ask people here and there to pick up the cup of wine, but not to hold it, you know, for the duration of Magid, even though you can put it down here and there. So that's the Sipur Yetzia Mitzrayim. It's a special, unique mitzvah. So that carries a cup of wine. And Hallel seems to be an ordinary text of Hallel that we're familiar with every time we say Hallel. There's only one catch. We never say Hallel at nighttime. Hallel is a daytime expression. L'hagid b'boker chazdecha. And Hallel always means that the storm is behind us. The nighttime is over. And that's what it means, l'hagid b'boker chazdecha. In the midst of nighttime, it's ve'emunatcha b'leilot. There you have to have fortified faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now's not the time for Hallel, in the midst of tzara. You hope that one day you will be able to say Hallel. Now you need petition, you need bakasha, you need trina, you need tzom, you need tears to get out of this light nighttime. But when you get out of the nighttime, you say Hallel. V'lagid b'boker chazdecha. So the one exception to halacha is Seder night. Seder night, where we say Hallel at night. So first of all, it's exception. So Chazal wanted to demonstrate it's so exceptional that Hallel on Seder night we'll say with a cup of wine. Over a cup of wine. Where normally we say Hallel on Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, and Chanukah in the daytime as part of davening. Nobody brings out a cup of wine for Hallel. On Sukkot, we say Hallel with Arba Minim. You know, that yes. With the Lulav and Esrei, because we're going to do the shaking of the Lulav. But we don't have it with a cup of wine. But a night of the Seder, we do it with a cup of wine because it's special. So this is the four cups of wine. Now the Yerushalmi, that's the halacha. But then the Yerushalmi comes along and says that there are all kinds of illusions. So the most popular and famous illusion is the four expressions of redemption. V'hotzeiti etchem, v'yitzalti, v'galti, v'lakachti. But the same page, three lines later, it says, it corresponds to the four times the word kos, cup, is mentioned in the dream of the Sarah Mashkim. Remember back in Parshat Vayeshev, when Yosef's sitting in jail, and the butler and the baker, the Sarah Mashkim, the Sarah Ofim, they both have dreams, and Yosef interprets both of them, and then 3 days later, it's birthday party time for Paroi, and he makes a big splash, and he restores Sarah Mashkim to his former glory, as Yosef interpreted the dream, and the Sarah Ofim, what was he doing? Nothing. He was just hanging around. He was hanging out, right? That's what he was doing. Right. So just because the Sarah Mashkim has, you didn't like that, okay? Just because Sarah Mashkim repeats the word "kos" four times in the dream, so I have to drink four cups of wine on Seder night. Obviously, there's a theme here. There's an idea, and that is that to mark the beginning of the galut. When does the galut, the exile in Mitzrayim, begin? It begins with the ascension of Yosef to become the vice king in Mitzrayim. Because that ultimately brings the family down. If not for that, the family would not have gone down. What was that? That's incidental. But because of the Ra'ah, because of the famine in Canaan, and Yaakov sends the children down, and they meet up with this strange man who takes Shimon for hostage and they wants to bring down the youngest son. And it ultimately developed, the whole story develops that Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim because Yosef is in that position. And Yosef achieving that position is a direct result of his interpretation of the dream of the Sarah Mashkim. So the exile to us on a certain level begins there, and therefore it's the beginning game. And Vehotzeiti, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakachti is the end game. So you have four expressions of Geula and four expressions of the beginning of the Galut, which is the reason why we drink four cups of wine. There's only one problem. There are five left expressions of Geula. It says, Veveti, and I will bring you into the land. I mean, just to have Vehotzeiti, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakachti is not enough. That's exactly what the Meraglim thought. That the Meraglim and the generation of the Midbar. You know, listen, it's not what Shamsha Fal Hirsch envisioned. What Geula is all about is Kabbalat HaTorah, and now we're sitting in the desert for 1 year, the whole business that we're sitting in for 1 year, when Moshe Rabbeinu sends the Meraglim to Eretz Canaan, and this 1 year was spent in a very, very religious and spiritual manner, because they didn't have a canyon, they didn't have bowling alleys, they didn't have ice skating, they didn't have cable TV. So what did they do day in and day out? They didn't even have shopping, no malls. They didn't have shopping because the clothing didn't deteriorate and so on. So what did they do all day? They didn't have to go to work. They sat and studied Torah. That's what they did. Men, women, and children. They sat and studied Torah. And the figuring was, this is a great existence, a wonderful existence. And the Meraglim came back from Eretz Canaan, and they reported that, you know, it's true, it's a wonderful country, Tova Aretz, and no question about it, and here are the fruits, look at the beautiful, it's only one catch. We're going to have to leave the Beit Midrash and start going to work. If you want to have these kind of fruits, you got to work. And if you want to defend the country, you have to work. You have to run a country. So there'll be time for Talmud Torah, but there'll be a lot of time outside the framework of Talmud Torah. And as the Ger Rebbe, the Sfat Emet, pointed out, but he said it only in a remez, but the Lubavitcher Rebbe said it clearly, that this was the chait of the Meraglim, Frumkeit. They just felt they didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael because they were engrossed in Torah study. And therefore, this was going to be Bitul Torah. The whole enterprise of going to Eretz Yisrael was Bitul Torah. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu said, if that's what you think the Torah and Eretz Yisrael is all about, you know, if Shal is Gorot Abasta, I'm closing up the shop, and you are through. Yitamu v'sham yamudu. Let's try again with the younger generation. But that generation lost it all. The Mishnah says in Sanhedrin, Ein lem chelik leolam haba, ve'ein tkuma v'triyat amitim. There is no yolam haba, no triyat amitim. This is a nation that saw everything. The Ten Makot, the Kriyat Yamsuf, Man, Ber Miriam, Kvat HaTorah. This is what they saw. Nobody saw what they saw. Ra'ata shivcha le'yam, ma'shelo ra'a Yecheskel ben Buzi HaKohen. I mean, a shivcha saw more than Yecheskel HaNavi of divinity. So they lose it all. They lose it all. Why? Because they thought that the Eretz Yisrael enterprise is the Bitul Torah. Sound familiar? And we have to be careful about this. We have to be careful. And who knows if this isn't the Lashon Hara that was said about Eretz Yisrael. You know, Meraglim Torah said Lashon Hara and Eretz Yisrael. What was the Lashon Hara? Who's the Lashon Hara? No, just a bit little tired to come to Eretz Yisrael, you know. In the Midbar, you know, we can study and so on. One has to be very, very careful. Very careful with this. So the fifth expression, Veheveti. Veheveti means we'll bring you into the land. So the Sam Poskim, or Rav Kasher, points out in his Haggadah Shlema, that most probably in days of Beit HaMikdash, they most probably drank a fifth cup of wine. And after the Churban, the idea was to maintain a fifth cup on the table, that in anticipation that one day we will drink the fifth cup of wine. Having said that, then perhaps for the last 67 years, at least those of us who live here in Eretz Israel, should drink at the fifth cup. This is the case to be made. Now the Rambam says that there are some who drink the fifth cup, so I don't do this, but it's not my minhag, obviously, we don't do this. There hasn't been really a serious call to drink the fifth cup, but in theory, we could drink a fifth cup. Now one thing is true, if there are really five cups, because really there are five expressions of Geula, and Veheveti is the complementary expression after the other four, it's that which, with the whole purpose of Yetziat Mitzrayim, was to bring us to Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, and not to leave us, dangling in the air in the desert. So that's why the Rambam, when he presents the Seder, and this is Egypt 12th century, he presents the Seder as if Beit HaMikdash is up and running. It's a very, very strange thing. In my experience in Rambam studies, The Rambam will always draw our attention to the fact that sometimes in Beit HaMikdash things are done differently. But he will first present the way we conduct our halachic business, and then only afterwards would gloss into, and at Beit HaMikdash they would do this as such and such. I'll give you a good example. Birkat Kohanim, we call in Yiddish Duchanim, which by the way comes from the word Duchan, the platform, and it wasn't the Kohanim on the Duchan, it was the Levium on the Duchan who was singing. They were on the Duchan, but somehow we just mixed up the Duchan of the Levium with the Duchanim, because Kohanim go up to the platform. So we called it Yiddish, we called it Duchanim. Fine, but it's Birkat Kohanim. And without getting into the whole story why Ashkenazim and Chutz La'aretz don't do Birkat Kohanim except for Musaf of Yom Tov, it's a shir in itself. But there's a mitzvah of Birkat Kohanim every single day. And that every day we do it during Tefillah. And it's really a mitzvah for Shacharit and Mincha, except the Chazal said, let's not do it for Mincha, because before they invented Coca-Cola, people drank wine for lunch. And a Kohen that drinks wine is disqualified from being a Kohen Mevarech. And because we're not going to start asking questions by Mincha, nu, did you have wine for lunch? The odds are some did, some didn't. So the Chazal eliminated Birkat Kohanim for every Mincha. That's why there's no Birkat Kohanim for Mincha. But in theory, there should be. And on a fast day where you're not eating or drinking, so really there should be Birkat Kohanim. But Chazal first said, there's a concept in halachic language called lo plug, no exception rule. If we're not doing it the whole year, we're not going to do it on a fast day also. But then the Gemara follows up and says, you know what? Normally, in the days of Chazal, Mincha was davened in the mid-afternoon, synchronizing the time framework with the time that they would offer the afternoon korban, tamid shel ben arbayim. But on a fast day, most people daven mincha very close to sundown, to shkia. So it had the flavor of nila. It was unusual, not like we do today. Most people daven mincha right before shkia and some after shkia, right? That's if you're a vision, it's a chassid, you know. But don't bother me with shkia. But nevertheless, shkia is the end zone for mincha, that's clear. So the Chazal say that in days of fast days, people would have mincha samuch l'shkia, and then it just had this flavor of nila. And on Yom Kippur, there is birkat kohanim for nila, as you know, we do birkat kohanim for nila. That's why there's no birkat kohanim for mincha on Yom Kippur, by the way. Even though there's a view in the Mishnah, we should have it four times on Yom Kippur: shachros, musaf, mincha, nila. We do it three times. But anyway, so the Rambam tells us all the halachot of birkat kohanim, and then he says, and by the way, in the Migdash, things were done a little differently. For example, instead of putting the hands out in front, the way the Kohanim do today, the Migdash, the hands were on top. And in the Beit HaMikdash, the Shem Hashem was the Shem Yud Kei Vav Kei, Shem HaMfurash. And in Beit HaMikdash, it wasn't three brachot, but it was one run-on bracha. All kinds of differences, which in itself deserves explanation. But I'm pointing out, when does the Rambam deal with the Migdash observance? At the end of his discussion, because he's sitting in Egypt in the 12th century talking about the halakha. So if you want to talk about Birkat Kohanim, let's talk about Duchening and Shul in the morning, tomorrow. Now we'll talk about it. You should also know that in the Mikdash things were done a little differently. And he does this consistently whenever there is a Beit HaMikdash factor. He'll always talk about it as a postscript to the halakha that he's presenting. He won't ignore it, because the Rambam said, I'm talking about everything, but I'm just talking about the chronological order of things. He will present it as if we're dealing with our business today, but in Yomot HaMashiach, you know, or the, when Beit HaMikdash stood, things were done somewhat differently. And Leil HaSeder, on the 8th chapter of Hilchot Chametz HaMatzah, the Rambam is going to teach us now the laws of Leil HaSeder. So he presents to us Leil HaSeder as if Beit HaMikdash is existing and running. And you think, one second, this is remarkable. I don't want to say ridiculous, but it's remarkable. Why would he do something like that? If you take a look at this source page, starting from source number 3, we'll get back to 1 and 2 in a second. Starting from source number 3, the Rambam reads, this is all 3 through 8 are all from 8th chapter of Hilchot Chametz HaMatzah. Umevi'im shulchan aruch, you bring the table that's set, ve'alav, the Rambam's shulchan aruch is not what we call shulchan orech in the Seder, which means mealtime. Right, you have a meal, right? It's a Yom Tov, so you have a Sudat Chag. So the Rambam says, you bring the table that was set up. We call the Ka'ara. What the Rambam here is describing is a coffee table. It's not the shulchan. Mevi'im shulchan. What do you schlep a table? Do you need four people to carry? He's talking about a coffee table that's going to be sitting in the living room the way we make our seder. And on the coffee table, we put a seder plate. But that, who invented the seder plate? The artist, the craftsman, the Jewish craftsman, and the artist, the Omanut Yehudit, that gave a certain embellishment. Just like the artist created the Hanukkah menorah. It doesn't say anywhere in the halacha that you have to have a Hanukkah menorah. It says you're supposed to light 8 candles. That's what you're supposed to do. So I remember when I used to set up the candles for the Rav in his apartment in New York, when he was there for Hanukkah. So we never had a menorah there, because he felt that you had to light candles in New York City way beyond a half an hour, which the normal skinny candles give you, 30, 35 minutes, 40 minutes, but matzav tov. He said, people are still coming home from work, at least an hour and a half, 2 hours, rush hour. He said, it's defined by rush hour. And if rush hour in the public transportation was 2 hours, from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, he said the candles had to burn till 7 o'clock. So we use Shabbos candles. Now, I didn't have Rav never made Shabbos there in the yeshiva in New York when I was there. It was in Boston. So we took a piece of silver foil. Remember, my brother told me to do this. Take a piece of silver foil, and you schmaltz in the candles, right? One next to the other. That was the Rav's Hanukkah candles. Did it say you have to have a menorah? Where did it say you have to have a menorah? You have to have candles. So the artists, you know, so that the Museum Yisrael and the Echal Shlomo Museum, they should have nice things to show. So there's a fancy menorahs. Fine. But it's, I'm not saying there's anything against it, by the way. I always have a nice menorah at home. Sada. But there's no halacha that you have to have it. And so too, there's no halacha you have to have a ka'ara, a seder plate, even though the Museum of Judaica is loaded with seder plates. The halacha tells us how you put down the various things on the table. The Zeroa, the Beitzah, the Charoset, the Moro, where do you put it? That is a tradition. There's a tradition. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch of Rav Gansfried from Hungary, he's got it drawn out. He doesn't have a table, he's got the words. You know, here, Zeroa, Beitzah, Moro in the middle. He spells it out, how to set up the Seder plate. So we put it on a plate. But the Rambam's talking about a little coffee table here, and that's his Kara. And what do you have on it? You have Maror and Yerek Acher. Maror, Yerek Acher, the Yerek Acher, the other vegetables for Karpas. Matzah, put the matzah on the table. Charoset. Gufo Shel Keves, that's the lamb chops. That's the lamb chops, right? That's Korban Pesach. Gufo Shel Keves HaPesach. And Basar Chagiga Shel Yom HaBasar. I believe I explained this already last week or the week before, that the Korban Pesach was not the main dish. It was the dessert. It was the kinuach. It's exactly when we eat matzah afrikaimen. How many of us are looking forward to eat the matzah of the afrikaimen after you stuff yourself with 10 tons of kneidlach already? Right? Who has a stomach to eat matzah afrikaimen? Why do we eat the matzah afrikaimen? Because it's a mitzvah. There's no other reason. Mamish l'shem shamayim. Nobody's interested in another kizayat matzah according to the shir of Chazon Ish. Nobody. Nobody's interested. But we do it. It's not just to hand out some gifts to those who stole the afrikaimen. That's just to keep the kids awake and so on. But the idea of eating the matzah afrikaimen is exactly where they ate the Korban Pesach. It was the dessert. So instead of having, you know, chocolate mousse with whipped cream, we're having a, you know, dry matzah with nothing on it. That's what we're going to eat for dessert. It's a wonderful dessert, right? So, very dietetic. Right. Terrible. So, why do we do that? Why is the Korban Pesach eaten at the end? Because one of the halachot of Korban Pesach is supposed to be eaten when you're already satisfied. Nechal al hasova. So you have to have a meal and you have to fill yourself up. You have to fill yourself up. So what did they use to fill themselves up? They brought a different Korban on Erev Pesach. And that was called the Chagigah of the 14th of Nisan. And that was the meat of the main course. Whatever it was, roast beef. Whatever it was, that's what they ate. So then when he got to the Afrikaimen, they're pretty much filled up. And no, I've seen situations where people were pretty much filled up and it looked like they were after Yom Kippur. That was when they bring out the Viennese table at weddings in America. The people have eaten already the smorgasbord, which is a full meal, right? And then they put away a full meal afterwards. My younger brother said, the only reason there's a chuppah is to make a hefsik between the smorgasbord and the dinner. It's the only reason. Or else, you know, it'd be a chila gasa. The whole thing would be a bracha levatola.
And then they bring out the Viennese table then, and you think that's after Yom Kippur, after Tisha B'Av, but people haven't eaten for a year. Where they pounce on it. I'm so out of it. We're in the country here, Baruch Hashem, 37 years. And I sometimes go back to the States, I go to a wedding, and I'm appalled to see, and nothing's changed, by the way. If anything, the Viennese table has gotten more developed. But so has the appetite. So here you have the Korban Pesach and the Chagigat Arba'asar on the Ka'ara. And then the Rambam says, underlined in source 3, Ubezman Hazeh, but today, Mevi'im al Shulchan, Shnei Minei Basar. You put two pieces of meat, Echad Zecha LePesach, Echad Zecha LeChagiga. Now Ashkenazim don't do this. Ashkenazim have the Zroa and the hard boiled egg, the Beitzah. Fine, okay. But the idea is, one represents that which we would have had the Korban Pesach, and the other is that second Korban. So what do we have here? The Rambam makes his presentation of Beit HaMikdash, of Leila Seder, that Beit HaMikdash is up and running, and there's Korban Pesach, and there's Korban Chagiga. But Bizman HaZeh, unfortunately, we don't have that, so we have a substitute. Then source number 4. The Rambam brings the Manishtana. How many questions of the Manishtana? 4 plus 1. He's got 5. He's got all the questions that we have. And then he has, Shebchol HaLeilot, Ono Ochlim, Basar, Tzli, Shaluk, Umuvushal. That we have meat that throughout the year that's cooked and potted and roasted, and halayla zeh kulot sli. It's only on the open fire. So then the Rambam tells us at the end of the Manishtana, Bizman Hazeh, source 4, Eino omer v'alayla zeh kulot sli, she'en lanu korban. Umatchil bignut v'korei ad shegomer drash parshat aram yerov ravi kula. And then you continue with the Haggadah, and you do the drasha of Aram Yerov Ravi, which we have in our Haggadah, until you finish the long-winded explanation of those psukim that are really a type of synopsis of the exile into Mitzrayim and the gula from Mitzrayim, redemption from Mitzrayim, that is said at the time that person brings Bikurim to Beit HaMikdash. But here we're using the Medrash to help us dig through the words and dig through the pieces and recreate the story by using the tool called Medrash. My question is, the idea of Matchil Begnut, by that you begin with the bad things of Mitchila of De Avodah Zarah of Yotenu, once upon a time we were idol worshippers, and once upon a time we were slaves. These aren't nice things to put on our bios. But nevertheless, it's important that we remember this, that you will appreciate more the redemption if it comes against the background of what once was. And therefore, we do have to spell it out. The political exile, the theological exile, yes, we were pagan worshippers, and we achieved Matan Torah, and things changed. So this is something radically different than discussion of the Manishtana. I would have expected that the Rambam gives us the 5 questions, and at the end of that halacha, tell us, but by the way, Bizman HaZeh, there's no question about the tzliyesh because we don't have a korban. And then move on to the next halacha. But look how he does it in source number 4. He writes, in the next halacha, this is after he finishes the discussion of the Manishtana. He says, Bizman HaZeh, Eino omer v'alayla zeh kulot tzli she'en lanu korban, a line that I would have expected should have been attached to the previous halacha, but the Rambam now sets it up as a new halacha, and then runs on, it's a run-on sentence, Umatchil Bignut, and by the way, you have to then continue by explaining that medrash of Aram Yerov Ravi until you complete the entire section. Well, I believe the Rambam did this deliberately, because he was drawing our attention to the fact that when we sit down to Leila Seder without Korban Pesach, that is the modern day Gnut. This is the Gnai. So if you want to figure it out, well, what is the Gnai? What's so wrong? Yeah, we're sitting here in Dinat Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, Reshit Zmichiat Kulateinu, almost 50% of Am Yisrael is here in Eretz Yisrael today, and we have Tzahal, and we have high-tech, and whatnot, and technology, and agriculture, and Shchitut. No. And, we have all kinds of wonderful things there, and so on. So, well, where's the Gnut? The Gnut is that we don't have Beit Mikdash. That's the Gnut. And you better remember that. She'ein lanu korban. And the Rambam just rams home that point of what Bizman HaZeh is all about, even though you might be living some type of illusion that everything is hunky-dory and everything's perfect. So again, in the Manishtana, the Rambam presents the Manishtana as if Beit HaMikdash is there. And then, as a parenthetical insert, he tells us what we do today. And then source number 5.
Umachzira Shulchan, we after a certain point of in the Haggadah, we hear that by us the Haggadah tells us to cover the matzah, uncover the matzah, you know, cover this, uncover that. The Rambam talks about this coffee table that's removed and brought back. Machzir Shulchan Lefanav veOmer, and then we say Pesach Ze Shano Ochlim. Why are we eating now the Korban Pesach? Obviously, that was said only in the days of Beit Hamikdash. Pesach Ze Shano Ochlim Hashem Shepasach Hamakom Abatei Avoteinu BeYitzrayim Shneimar VaAmartem Zev Pesach Ul Hashem. But then Bezman Hazeh. But today we say Pesach Shayu Avoteinu Ochlim Bezman Shabeit Hamikdash Kayam Al Shum. Why did they once upon a time eat Pesach? So again, where does the Bezman Hazeh come in? It's an afterthought. It was after he's already presented the Seder as if Beit HaMikdash exists, and why we're explaining Korban Pesach, because Korban Pesach is here, and then, by the way, Korban Pesach isn't here, so we have to adjust the text. And source number 6, the bracha at the end of Magid is Baruch Atah Hashem V'chotem, and you end Baruch Atah Hashem V'kenem Cholam Asher Ge'alanu V'ga'alat Avoteinu Mimitzrayim V'higiyanu L'alayla Hazeh L'chol Bo Matzah U'Maror. Wonderful, here we are. But then the Rambam says, one second, but there's a lot more to this bracha today. Ubezman hazeh, today, after the Churban, we actually ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu that He should give us the opportunity to have a complete Seder, recognizing our Seder is incomplete. Mosif kein, Mosif, you add. Kein Hashem Elokeinu Kevoteinu, this will be familiar because we say this in our Gada. Yagienu lemoadim v'lirgalim achirim habayim likrateinu l'shalom smechim b'vinyan irecha sasim b'avodatecha v'nochal sham min hazvachim min hapsachim shiyagia damam al kir mizbachacha l'ratzon v'nodelecha shir chadash al gulateinu v'apetut nafshenu v'oruch atah Hashem gal Yisrael. The Rambam says that in Zman Hazem we have a type of tchina. I'm sorry I didn't bring this here, but I have at home a tefillah, type of tefillah bracha, that was written by a Rav from Amsterdam. I'm trying to remember the name for a second, I'm trying to remember it. And he was brought to Bergen-Belsen. And it was in the middle of the Seder. He was a very important Rav. A Rav that was involved in many serious shelot already during the time of the war, because of Agunot issues and other issues. And he was eventually taken, and he was taken to Bergen-Belsen, and it was Pesach time. And obviously, you know, what they gave them to eat was what they gave them to eat, was a half a slice of bread. And we know they were given about 450 calories a day, and most people died. Those who survived the initial selection and were not put to death immediately, most of them perished from starvation because of subhuman conditions, and you need at least 1200 calories a day just to make it through, and here they were given a third of that. So here he was eating bread on Pesach, and he knew he had to eat it because of Pekuch Nefesh. So he composes a bracha. You can cry, and the bracha is basically echoes the spirit of this bracha, where he says Asher Kedshanu B'Savetzivanu Al Mitzvat V'Chai Bahem. The mitzvah is that, yeah, this is the mitzvah I'm being Mekayim now. The Torah says I'm supposed to live. But he continues the bracha that Kadosh Baruch Hu should give him the strength, Yagi'enu l'rigaim mo'adim re'im le'chol bo matzah u'maror. That's all he wants. He should have the schut of once again. He never makes it, by the way. He perishes in he succumbs days before the shechur of Bergen-Belsen. He dies, yeah. So one of millions of tragedies. So in source number 7, the Rambam tells us, you know, get to this point, now you eat the Korban Pesach. But he says, Bezman hazeh, she'ein shem korban. So then you make hamoitzi on the al-chilat matzah, and so on. And at the end too, bachrona ochel mibsar ha-pesach hafilu kizayit ve'no to'e macharav klal. This is the fulfillment of Korban Pesach. Ubizman hazeh ochel kzayit matzah ve'no to'em acharav achareha kulam kulum. So this is the matzah of Afikoman that we take instead of the Korban Pesach. So again, you have 6 times that the Rambam is going to say bizman hazeh. So I ask, manishtana, why are these halachot different that the Rambam sees fit to present the Beit HaMikdash setting as being the text on the table, and only as an afterthought, what we do today, where in all other areas of halacha, the Rambam presents the halacha at hand
And almost as an afterthought, he tells us what the procedure was or will be in the days of Beit HaMikdash. Manishtana. Why is this different? I think the answer lies in the title of the shir here. Bechol dor v'dor chayav adam leharot or lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatzam mimitzrayim. In every generation, you're obligated to envision yourself as if you yourself have gone out of Mitzrayim. Now exactly what does this mean, and what is the difference between lirot and liharot? So let's look at the two sources, one and two. Rambam in the Laws of Chametz HaMatzah, Perek Zayin, writes, "Behold, over dor chayav adam liharot et atzmo ki'ilu hu batzmo yatza ata mishibud Mitzrayim." Liharot, to demonstrate, is to do something. Now, the source number two is the Nusach Haggadah, and I brought the first line down. The Rambam starts by writing, Nusach Haggadah shenagu b'Yisrael b'zman ha'galut kachu. And in this Nusach Haggadah, there are all the requisite changes that the Rambam introduced in the Halakha under the title b'zman hazeh, b'zman hazeh, b'zman hazeh. So he's got that all factored in to the Nusach Haggadah, because he's giving us the Haggadah that's relevant for today's day and age, Egypt, 12th century. And here it says, "B'chol davador, chayav adam again leharot et atzmo kilu yatzam mimitzrayim." Well, it's the same thing, no? Yeah, it's the same thing in the print of the computer of the Project Hashut of Bar Ilan, but it's not the same thing in the manuscripts. And they took a stand. The editors of the Project Hashut, the response project of Bar Ilan, took a stand on which language, which version of the Rambam's language to print. Because if we happen to use a standard Haggadah, standard, that you probably have about 5,000 at home, it will read, "Behold of Ador Chayav Adam Lirot et Atzmo Kilu Yatzam Mitzrayim." If you open up a Mishnah, Maseret Pesachim, that's most probably what it's going to say. "Behold of Ador Chayav Adam Lirot et Atzmo Kilu Yatzam Mitzrayim." If you open up a standard Rambam, not the Nusach Haggadah, but the Halachot, Hilchot Chametz HaMatzah, Perek Zayin, it's going to say, "Behold of Ador Chayav Adam Leharot et Atzmo Kilu Yatzam Mitzrayim." But in the Nusach Haggadah, it's going to read, "Behold of Ador Chayav Adam Lirot et Atzmo Kilu Yatzam Mitzrayim." Now, our Rebbe the Rav, who was the greatest of the great, as you all know, was not particularly concerned about exploring the various variant readings. Not that he was totally oblivious from it, but this was not his day-to-day learning at all. At all. While his son, Rav Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, Pashut made a living on variant readings. That's what he does in terms of halakhic literature for history purposes. And through Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, I developed a sensitivity to this mode of learning as well. I say the Rav was not totally oblivious, because when he was in Berlin in 1926, 27, when he was about 23, 24 years old, he had an uncle in Warsaw whose name was Rav Krakowski. And this Rav Krakowski, Zichron Levracha, wrote a sefer on the Rambam called Avodat HaMelech. He wrote a very lengthy sefer, except as what happened to many, many Sfarim in Europe because of the Shoah, many manuscripts of Sfarim just got destroyed, lost, burnt, and whatever. But on the first book of the Rambam, Sefer Mada, it survived. I don't know the history of why it survived, but it survived and was published here by Moshe Rav Kook in Eretz Yisrael. And this Rav Krakowski, sitting in Warsaw in the 20s, was also very, very careful before he explained the Rambam to get a good reading on what the Rambam really said, and suspecting that sometimes the print may have a corrupt text. And if there was a corrupt text and we have available manuscripts for comparative purposes, let's check it out before I say something dumb. So he calls on his nephew, Rav Yosef Dov Ber, and he calls him Bet Gimel, Ben Gisi, son of my brother-in-law. Ben Gisi Hayakar, my dear nephew. That's what he calls him. They're called by name. My Ben Gisi. And he's mentioned twice. The Rav's mentioned twice in this book. Anonymously, as Bet Gimel Yakiri, my dear brother-in-law, not nephew, my dear nephew. Can you do me a favor? And in the library in Berlin, there are some manuscripts of the Rambam. can you check out this halacha and that halacha and transcribe for me what the nusach is, because I want to say something about it. So you see, this Rav Kronkowski did his homework, but he sent the Rav to be a shliach, to do the homework, do the legwork, and dig up the manuscripts. So the Rav knew of the existence of the manuscripts. And I say this because the Rav many times would say phenomenal things that today, because of our awareness of manuscript, the themes and thoughts that the Rav said were gold, and they remain gold, and it's still Torah, and you still have to say a Birkat HaTorah. The only thing is it's probably not what the Rambam thought, because the Rambam wrote something else. So these things we have to be careful about. Now what the Rav said once, and it was really a remarkable idea, and I love it, he said the difference between Lirot and Laharot is that we know that positive commandments are fulfilled in one of three ways. Beficha bilvavcha la'asoto. It's a pasuk in Nitzavim. Either verbally, like tefillah, kriyat shema, you articulate, kiddush, Friday night, you say something, you articulate something. Beficha bilvavcha means in thinking, doesn't mean your heart beats. Means it's the thought process, like the mitzvah of knowing that God exists, and avat Hashem and yirat Hashem, these are mitzvot that you fulfill. You don't have to lift your finger to fulfill them. And la'asotot means you have to pick yourself up and do something. Whatever the action might entail, it's a la'asotot. When the Mishnah tells us, b'chol dovador, chayav adam, lirot et atzmo, kilu yatzad mimitzrayim, is this a mitzvah or a chiyuv, an obligation, that's just mental, intellectual? Is it verbal? Is it something that calls for action? If it says, b'chol dovador, chayav adam, lirot et atzmo, you're supposed to consider yourself, then you most probably can fulfill it, certainly by thinking and fascinating, engaging in some type of mental fascination about you going out of Mitzrayim, and maybe talking about it around the table. But you don't have to do anything, you don't have to lift a finger. If you say leharot, that means you have to demonstrate. And there were Kilot Yisrael, who minag was to sit with on Seder night with a stick, And a little going out of Mitzrayim, you know, pekala, and you know, and so on. And remember, Rav Yaakov Meidan says, one second, today we have to put on your hiking shoes, and you take out your tarmil, your backpack, and so on. And you're going, and he used to say, I remember Rav Yaakov Meidan said, I come to shul with, you know, a nice jacket and a white shirt and everything. But Seder, I'm going on a 40-year journey. I'm going to wear a tie and a white shirt. So he puts on a shlak shirt, you know, for the Seder night. And you know, jeans and hiking shoes, and he says, this is, you want to do something, you want to show that you're going to take a walk now, so you have to update it to the 21st century. This is how I go on a hike, on a tiyul, because I would do it differently. I would take out my suitcase and my passport and my boarding pass, right? I do things differently than Rav Yaakov Meidan, but alright, each to his own. That's what it says, behold over door, you know, each to his own. But certainly not with a stick and a little pekala, you know, hanging on a pole. That's not how I wouldn't walk like that today. So, but it's a call for some type of action. So Rav suggested that when the Rambam wrote the Nusach Hagadah, as he says, galut, you know, in the Galut, Jews were impotent to do anything about their situation. So the only thing they could do is inside the house, talk about it. They could certainly think about it, and at best talk about it. Hold over the door, chayav adam lirot et atzmo. Consider yourself. But if the Beit HaMikdash is up and running, and you are an independent person in an independent Jewish country, you can do something about it. So there the mitzvah is upgraded to laharot et atzmo. Isn't that a beautiful idea? The only problem is, the Rambam never said that. That's the only problem. That's the only problem. It's a wonderful idea. It's a wonderful idea, and I cherish it, believe me. But in both sources, the Mishnah Torah source of the Hilchot Chametz Matzah Perek Zayin, and in the Nusach Haggadah, in the manuscript world, both show up. Either Lirot or Leharot. Either in the Halachot or in the Haggadah, or both, interchangeable in either direction. Now, as Rav Chaim Soloveitchik pointed out, manuscripts, how do you gauge the success of a sefer? The printing press was invented in the late 15th century, so by the 16th century, there's no more manuscripts of Rambam. Rambam is all in print. So you have early prints of the Rambam, for sure. But there's no more manuscripts. The manuscripts of Rambam is 400-year phenomenon, from 12th century to 16th century. Now, if you examine the world of manuscripts, illuminated manuscripts, and so on, You see that Chumashim were copied, Sidurim were copied, Megillat Esther was copied, Haggadah Shel Pesach was copied. These are something that people would invest to buy the parchment and have somebody copy. It was a fortune to copy a Sefer. But how many people at home had a Shas? Who had a Shas? The Shul had a Shas, the Beis Medrash had a Shas, the rich person in town had a Shas, maybe the Rav had a Shas. Today I have a Shas here. Everybody has a Shas. Right, you download Trottenstein, it's no big deal. Right, Kahati Mishnah is for free. Yeah. For free. And Schottenstein costs a little money. That's why I'm waiting for most of it until it becomes free. Then I'll download it. But everything else they have free, right? The whole Tanakh, they're free. Download. And then, who had Sfarim Bichlal? In 1263, when they burnt the Sfarim in Paris, they practically burnt every Gemara in Paris. It was a bonfire. That was every Gemara they had in Paris. That's what it was. So the success of the Rambam, that was such a popular Sefer, generated the idea that there are 800 extant manuscripts of the Rambam. Phenomenal. Of which 96 are complete from the first to the 14th book. And the rest are incomplete. Incomplete means either one book or 13 books or anything in between. Which means on any given halakha, you have at least 200, 300, 400 places to look and compare in the world of manuscript. That's how many manuscripts of Rambam we have today. So we are well equipped with the information, and we know. And on that basis, in the Shabtai Frankel edition of the Rambam that I have here, this came out in 1975, they opted to print in both places, Leharot, Leharot. They opted because they felt that this was probably what the Rambam wrote in both places based on the manuscripts. When I was teaching in the Muna College back in the 90s, so I would give a course in Jewish art to the wonderful Tal Midot, who was studying graphic arts and fine arts. So I dabbled in Jewish art then. And there was an illuminated manuscript of Haggadah Shel Pesach that had nikud, we call pentelach, dots. And it read there, Bechol dovador chayab adam, lamed resh aleph vav taf. But the nikud was larot. Not lirot, larot. What does larot mean? Leharot. As the Rashi tells us in Parashat B'Shalach, lehanchotam baderech, lanchotam baderech. Beginning of Parashat B'Shalach, so Rashi says, kimo lehanchotam. The hay becomes assimilated into the lamed and then carries a patach. So lehanchotam becomes lanchotam, or leharambam larambam. It's leharambam. So it's la, not lerambam, but la, with a patach. Larambam. So larot means lehaot. So some, why were they stingy on the hay? Because they were stingy on letters, because the parchment cost a fortune, and it could be it was the end of the line. So they saved the hay, and they wrote lamed resh v'alev vav taf, and they put a patach, and to realize that it's larot. But then there were other copyists who didn't see the nikud, and they just wrote lamed resh alev vav taf. And then some thought this was Li'ot. And this is how, this is the genesis of a textual mistake. Mistake. So the word is not Li'ot. The word is Li'ha'ot or La'ot. Take your pick, but it's the same thing. Li'ot and La'ot. And that's what the Rambam wrote. He wrote Li'ha'ot with a hey in both places. And some places they abbreviated it by writing Lamed Resh Aleph Vav Taf. But it's La'ot. So when you read it in the Haggadah this year, you should say, "Behold, of Adar, Chayav Adam, Laot et Atzmo." So if you read Stewie Weiss, Rabbi Stewie Weiss from Ranana's piece last Friday in the Jerusalem Post, so he ends it with a little interesting quip: "Manishtana halayla zeh." Says, you know, there's I'll predicate this. You know, there was a joke that I love to say in Poland because it's part of my repertoire of. What they call Polish jokes. Now, I want you to know that my Polish guide on the bus, she loves my Polish jokes. She begs me for more Polish jokes. She says they're all right, they're all correct, and she thinks and they love to poke fun at themselves, just like Jews poke fun at themselves too. Ask Jackie Mason, he does it all the time. He makes a living doing that. So, of course, the famous joke is how many poles they need to change a light bulb. The answer was 3. 1 to hold the bulb and 2 to turn the guy around. Which, incidentally, when I taught Midreshet Moria, we were in Poland, and there were 3 girls in a room, and the bulb burnt out. They called the desk, and 3 guys came up. And they cracked up. They thought it was so funny. These guys didn't know what they were laughing about. But this joke about the how many poles you need to change a light bulb generated about 20 different questions. How many such and such need to change a light bulb? How many Lubavitchers do you need to change a light bulb? The light never burnt out. Yeah. Right. How many Orthodox rabbis do you need to change a light bulb? Change? On that note, Rabbi Stewie writes, Ma? Nishtana? Change? Balayla hazeh. Tonight, we are asked to change. And the Rambam changed. He changed it. He said that tonight, we're going to be lahaot et atzmenu. We're going to force ourselves to demonstrate that Beit HaMikdash is up and running. So the laws of Leila Seder are going to be the laws of Beit HaMikdash. Now, unfortunately, we're going to come down to reality 3 seconds later. B'zman hazeh, this we don't do, this we do. But let's get back up to the laharot et atzmo. And ke'ilu, our kids and grandchildren have loved that word. This whole country is one big ke'ilu. It's every second word that they use in their language. L'chol dov ador chayav adam le'ol et atzmo ke'ilu yetzai Mitzrayim. Which means that our Seder is not our parents' Seder, it's not our grandparents' Seder, but our Seder is our Seder in our historic context, in our current events. That's what the Leila Seder has to be. It's not just a take off of last year's Seder. It's got to be somehow revised and updated, and that really means that our Seder goes through a change. And we are so conservative, we're so careful about maintaining, so the kid asks, change? Ma nishtana? And the answer is, alayla hazeh. Alayla hazeh, that's what it's all about. It's about doing that necessary shinui. V'tzarich lasot shinui kedei shishalu atinokot v'yishalu v'yamru ma nishtana alayla hazeh mikol alaylot. Sheikh chag sameach.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you.